been a and they could have done the Texas switch, because they just go, and it's not even a Texas switch. He chases the guy in, and then they come back out, and he kicks his ass in the street in a wide shot in The Irishman, and you, like, he can't throw a punch because he can't raise his arm, and he can't kick because he can't move his fucking 70-year-old Robert De Niro hips.
Ben Franklin's illegitimate son. Yep.
That's a weird plasticine golem pretending to be Tom Hanks.
And we're back. Hey, guys.
Howdy doody.
Welcome back to another episode of the Crowded Theater Podcast. I am Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Cliff.
And this is an exciting episode. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing well.
Pretty excited to talk about an exciting new movie.
Yes.
A good one.
So what is the movie we're talking about today?
The movie we're talking about is Here. A movie that is directed by Robert Zemeckis, getting the cast back together from Forrest Gump, 30 years after Forrest Gump.
Indeed we are. We're seeing the kind of spiritual sequel to Forrest Gump, reuniting Robert Zemeckis, Tom Hanks, Robin Wright, and screenwriter Eric Roth, who wrote Forrest Gump way back in the day.
And don't forget composer Alan Silvestri.
And Alan Silvestri. Hell yes, Alan Silvestri.
Who also composed the score for Predator, which is why I'm wearing this Predator shirt. Because I don't have a Forrest Gump shirt.
That's a good connection. I wouldn't have made that, but that is cool. That is one of his most... That is one of Alan Silvestri's coolest themes. It's very Basil Polidorus. It's very tough. It's very masculine. It's very different than his music for these films, which is also very good. And speaking of which, we went and saw not too long ago. We saw *Romancing the Stone*, Robert Zemeckis, Alan Silvestri's first collaboration, I think, at the Paramount Theater just a few months ago. Very good screening. This is a funny movie because we all have an interesting relationship, I think, with Robert Zemeckis. Quite literally, I and also Cliff participated in doing an entire podcast about the career of Robert Zemeckis, director of Forrest Gump, Back to the Future, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, as well as a lot of other great, more mischievous films early on, like Used Cars and I Want to Hold Your Hand, which I strongly recommend everyone go check out. Taylor, a literal 90s baby, grew up with Forrest Gump and is one of her all-time favorite movies, as it is mine. So tell me about Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump has just always been a movie that just has always been around. I want to say it even came out in 1996, the year I was born. So I've just always lived in a world of Forrest Gump. And it just has been one of those movies that you can watch twice in the same day and still get something new each time you watch it. It's just one of those movies that I feel like I grew up with and grew up with me, almost.
And we, not too long ago, went and actually saw Forrest Gump in a theater when we were doing kind of warm-up episodes to start recording this podcast. We did just some audio-only kind of test episodes, and one of the things we did was go see Forrest Gump, and one of my favorite things about that screening is that Taylor cried from minute one all the way until the end of that movie. Tell us about that screening experience.
Forrest Gump is just a movie that really means a lot to me, to explain the tears throughout the whole performance. I think it might have been the first and only time I'd ever seen it in theater, and as a big part of this podcast is that seeing movies in theaters do give you that extra oomph of experience, and I've seen the movie probably a million times. But
we watched it at home before, and I can tell you it took you minutes longer to start crying than you watched it at home, but it's definitely... I think it also just speaks, again to the unique power of the cinematic experience, that you just become so dialed into every moment of Forrest Gump when you're with a bunch of strangers in kind of reverent silence watching that feather fall down at the beginning, that it intensifies it to the point where you were just a mess from the beginning.
Throw out just small things that you take for granted when you watch movies on the small screen of your home TV versus the big screen of a theater TV, is I had never really even noticed all the doves that were in Forrest Gump.
The birds who explode behind him every time he would talk about Jenny?
Every time he would talk about Jenny, or even every time Jenny was in screen, there was like birds taking off in the background, which... Mm-hmm. Makes so much sense and is so beautiful. It honestly makes watching it in a theater so much more special. But then again, it's just one of those types of movies that every time I watch it, I find something else to gravitate and chew on. And so,
Well, that's the thing. It's a great transition to talk about the movie we are talking about now, because Robert Zemeckis, not only does he use some of those same techniques in this film, a lot of the same ideas that he does I remember there's even a moment, and we'll kind of get deeper into this in a moment, where Paul Bettany talks about someone who died, in the war, and they just use the window behind him being illuminated by headlights suddenly. It's almost as if Paul Bettany's soul was leaving his body. And the ideas like that, literally characters and things branching out in the frame, because we only have one frame in this movie, we'll get to that in just a moment, as well as literally using a lot of the same bird symbols. Like there's a hummingbird that kind of signifies very similar things in this film to the birds that are in Forrest Gump. But let's get down to it. I just want to kind of to tee it up, to frame it up, if you will. This film is Here, directed by Robert Zemeckis. And it is a very, 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 very unique movie. I think a completely singular movie. I can't think of anything at all like it that has ever been attempted in the history of cinema. I mean, there's many one-shot movies. There are movies. There's even filmmakers like, I forget his name, one of the Andersons, that guy who did A Pigeon Sat on His Branch Contemplating Existence, which will does large stories in a single kind of angle, unmoving, which is really cool. I dig all of that, but no one has ever, and this is what this movie does, is it tells the entire story from within the living room of a house, which is, again, many movies have done, but it does it all from a single POV, a single angle. The camera does not move, it just holds a single frame through mostly decades and decades of the 20th century, which we investigate, you know, thoroughly, and we see many different families occupying this house, but also a broader spectrum of time, and that we see not only the construction of the house, but we literally go all the way back to the beginning of time, to dinosaurs, to the asteroid. We literally see dinosaurs, dinosaur eggs, dinosaurs fleeing, all from the same POV, where presumably one day this not unlike an egg, which because we open on some eggs that are get stepped on, the house will literally grow up around and encapsulate, not unlike a protective shell, this POV, which is now naked and raw in nature. You know, literally, you see eggs being born and then stamped on immediately by the chaos of nature, followed by an asteroid, followed by floods and all these years of chaos, until eventually, you know, you see an entire
life. Skip over the woolly mammoths and then you get right to Native Americans and the American wilderness.
But you see like an entire tree like do its whole lifespan and everything, which is very beautiful. Then the tree gets cut down and you see civilization. And you see our perspective. And it perhaps does a greater job of creating a kind of uncanny sense of the POV of a movie looking into a world than any extended tracking shot POV, which still gives you a sense of, like, corporeal presence. Or, you know, even like, you know, when David Fincher back in the day would do that gimmicky shit where, like, the camera would go through the, like, fucking handle on a coffee cup. By not moving, if you have no sense of scale, no sense of distance, you just sort of are in this here and now, this presence, which obviously more so than just a literal description of the visual conceit of the film. The question is, okay, what do they do with that? Is the movie about something? Is it about something that, and is that thing emotionally resonant? Is it worth watching this movie in this living room? And I can just say, just categorically off the top, that the film is pretty fucking brilliant, and it not only does it imbue that conceit or imbue that visual thing with meaning and emotion and tremendous emotional resonance, but I cannot imagine it is simultaneous. It is as above, so below. You could not have told this story in this resonant way without this visual conceit, and you couldn't have told a better story or addressed different themes within this visual conceit that would have made it any more resonant or powerful. It is sort of all things. It is a simultaneous contemplation of space, or I should say a place, probably more so than space. You know, Here is literally the title of the movie, and it is a contemplation of time. You know, because not only do we see this vast expanse of time, but time is non-linear and random. And the other interesting conceit of the film is, which was a bit surprising to me, is one could see, and perhaps they even attempted this, a linear version of the movie where we start at caveman and we end in the future. Mm-hmm. And that might be interesting and elegiac or something, but instead it's all over the place. It's jumping in and out of time, and it does that to great effect, not only to keep the film fascinating and interesting and cool, as it, like, will use particular objects within the space to denote particular times. Like the rock, there's a rock that's present in the foreground for a substantial portion of history, including the Ice Age, that later on the television is where that rock is. And so, like, you'll be directed using just sound cues to, like, the TV where, you know, the Beatles are on Ed Sullivan, you know, which is, like, a fun, hilarious reference to Bob Zemeckis' first film, like, a subtle homage, which is takes place in time. It was just called I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I strongly recommend everyone go check it. It's mischievous, it's sexual, it's hilarious, and it takes place all on the day of the Ed Sullivan performance of the Beatles. So anyway, I recorded an entire episode of a podcast about it. Go watch that. But it'll direct your eye to that, and then that TV will then will become the rock that was there in ancient history, and all of a sudden we'll be with Native Americans, and we will be there before the house even began. And then at the end, a squirrel climbs up a tree, and you realize that this skinny tree off to the side is the mighty oak that gets cut down. And it just has really smart, simple graphic ideas that help denote these different periods of time, the presence of the rock, the size of the tree, whether the house is there or not. And yet it uses that to tell jokes and kind of make interesting points and all sorts of great stuff. And to the point where even the non-linearity and the fact that time itself is like doesn't exist and dissolves ends up being the most esoterically and thematically significant thing about the movie. To use a quick example as shorthand for the rest of the movie, you know, Paul Bettany is the aging man whose wife has died, and he is kind of getting up in the middle of the night, where now he's living back with his son on the couch in the living room, the pull-out couch, the old grandfather. And the film edits, and this is, you know, editing, but the film edits between a moment in the 1950s where his now dead wife just wanders into the living room. And the whole scene is maybe 10 seconds long, where she wanders into the living room and says, "Oh, what was I doing in here? I can't remember why I was in here. I can't remember." And this idea of forgetting is very, very important, and we'll come back later. And she wanders out of the room, and then it cuts to the present day when Paul Bettany gets up, and he thinks he's heard his wife's voice, and he's moving in the walker, and he's like, I'm coming, Rose, I'm coming to get you," or whatever he says. And we realize that the non-linearity, or these different times we are jumping into, is not editing. This is not, at least it is not in that, it is not purely just the order in which we are seeing the scenes of the movie. It's making a greater point in its continuous presence, which is that time does not exist. That all of these events are, in a sense, simultaneous if viewed from the POV of God or the spiritual world. And the film actually addresses and questions
from the POV of here. Yes.
From the POV of here, of being here, of being now. And there's, and it takes, and we can kind of get to the end.
And that, by the way, I was going to bring up that moment, just because that's kind of a moment unique in the movie where it tries to draw, like, actual, you know, causal relations between what's going on in the past and what's going on in the present, as if a spirit from the past is speaking to someone in the present and affecting the present, say the present of Paul.
But think about how effective it is, but how fucking subtle it is. It's not like they do some weird stylistic convention and she comes up and she talks into the camera and he sits up and he receives a message from her. It's just
even more direct, where she like sits down on the bed with him and puts his hands like, "Come home with me." Or
exactly,
something.
Like it doesn't do anything like that. Instead, it's this thing that's very subtle and yet it's very explicit, to the extent that just by having one scene and then the next scene, because the frame never moves, because everything is laid on top of each other, it immediately creates this meaning. So it becomes a kind of Rosetta Stone, not unlike the scene like where the water's pouring in through the roof, and then later on Tom Hanks is, you know, it becomes a kind of Rosetta Stone for how to interpret the rest of the movie, or the meaning for the rest of the movie, that's very clear, while at the same time being incredibly subtle to the point where it's just another moment that passes by, and it's just, it doesn't draw emphasis to itself. So I don't know. It's just very powerful. It's almost, there's too much to unpack in one podcast, because there's simultaneously the film itself, then there's what the film seems to be trying to convey, and we'll try and parse all of this out in a moment, and then there's the fact that every single moment of the film is kind of entirely new ideas and entirely just new formal things that you kind of marvel at, because it has to be, because there's no other way to tell, there's no other film that's quite been told in this way, that kind of uses the general orientation of the eye to the left towards this tree to then bring us into a whole new world or a whole new time. But
I even, like, early on into the movie, I kind of assumed Because again, we went in, we knew the conceit of the movie, but we didn't really know plot-wise or anything. So at the beginning of the movie, I kind of assumed like, oh, this will be kind of like a one-set stage play, mm-hmm. especially yeah. like with Tom Hanks as an older man kind of setting out, blah, blah, blah. And then as soon as you get the idea of all of like, the intercutted squares,
frames within frames
even, yeah. You immediately realize, like, oh, like, hey, you can kind of picture this story on a stage, which is very fun. I would love to see this somehow adapted that mm-hmm. way. But immediately you realize how particular film is needed for this story to also be told.
Yes, the idea of, I mean, it's something that, again, we can talk about, that the other thing that the film uses is not just... its unsubtle element, or in the best way, is that this device of creating what are like little squares wreathed in white, little mm-hmm. frames within frames that allow us to not just see a bunch of different scenes from this perspective, but see at times. It sounds confusing, and yet it is executed very elegantly, mm-hmm. and it uses sound design to usher us between those things. But it shows us a window into one time while viewing another time, or multiple times at the same moment, so that you're seeing the geographical relationship between these things as they would exist in this here, and yet you're seeing them absent time, so they're all simultaneous. And obviously there's a tremendous amount of poetic potential when you can see all of these different times layered upon each other, see a baby and an adult at the same time. And it really explores that. I really want to see the film again, because I feel like there were just so many things, visually and otherwise, little ideas that just they were kind of hard to take in all at once. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, basically it was just a universal transition device. That's going into the movie. We didn't know, knowing its basic conceit of being from one point of view, didn't really know how it would transition from one mm-hmm. scene to the next. And so it develops a pattern and a rhythm you very quickly get used to. Mm-hmm. You're in one scene, and then a frame gets drawn in the middle or to the side or at some strategic yeah. place in the present you're watching. And then we see a time from another time fade into that spot, mm-hmm. and then a transition. So it's just a universal language of transitions mm-hmm. that gets more and more complicated and sophisticated as it goes. But yeah. that's kind of what, you just get used to it. Yeah. It starts very slow and then kind of develops from there.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I also like how both the timelines, I liked how both the timelines, like you were saying, interconnected subtly, but then also even more directly. Like, for example, you're kind of cutting in between both a Native American timeline, a colonial revolutionary Benjamin Franklin timeline, and then a couple of other decades throughout America. But just for example, there is a very big part of the Native American storyline where a couple gives his partner, his wife, a beautiful handmade necklace, and that's kind of her icon throughout her storyline. And then later on, it is just very directly found in the backyard of this house. And so even in intercut frame of frame, subtle, like, windowed ways, but then also even more tangible, direct ways. And, for example, there's the whole conversation of whether or not Benjamin Franklin's going to be remembered in the revolutionary timeline, interwoven with the fact that they're dressed up as Benjamin Franklin for Halloween or for some sort of party. And the house across the street was the house that the Franklins lived in. So you kind of always see this house, mm-hmm. like, right through the window. Mm-hmm. So, yes, both subtle and direct connections. Yeah.
And that's actually another great point just to talk about, is the what makes it work within a living room, and why a living room, which we can get into later, is that this living room is, of course, archetypal of Americana. It's the same way in which the whole of America, more so than Americana, but Americana, just like with Forrest Gump, which is often sort of erroneously characterized as sort of nostalgia bait for baby boomers, but is using the idea of nostalgia to make a kind of greater point about America, contemplating its sins, contemplating its relationship with God. At the same time, this film uses that Americana as its iconographic substrate that it's reorganizing. Like the film, the couple, probably one of the best characters in the movie, aside from Tom Hanks and Robert Wright, is the 1930s couple, who are the girls dancing to jazz music, so they'll use a frame within a frame to transition back there. But how do they make their money? They do it with a Lazy Boy, a Lazy Boy recliner, something that exists not only in a living room. He turns out that this guy who's living in the house in the 1930s is an inventor, and he's tinkering, and he's tinkering, and he's tinkering, and he's clearly inventing
the Relaxy Boy.
His Relaxy Boy recliner, and he eventually makes it good.
Gets it an ottoman, gets it a headrest, it goes 180 degrees.
But it's something that that even though it speaks to a larger story, it literally speaks to a time of tremendous optimism, a time of tremendous growth, a time when,
everyone was looking forward to a bright future.
Exactly, what he even says. I think 1941 is going to be a really bright year, or whatever, and then with the irony from the perspective where time doesn't exist, that he doesn't know that
the U.S. is going to get pulled into World War II and
exactly,
all that stuff.
Exactly.
Japanese attack Pearl Harbor over the radio right after he says that. Yada, yada,
exactly.
Yada.
And those are the kind of things, fixating on the radio, telling that kind of allows to transition in time. But again, it uses that. It uses Native Americans and not woolly mammoths. It uses Benjamin Franklin instead of some other thing, because it's, again, just like Forrest Gump, which uses nothing but sort of classic American iconography to make a lot of interesting points about how America views. I mean, if you just do the kind of 25 words or less version on Forrest Gump. In Forrest Gump, is, you know, not a movie about a mentally handicapped guy necessarily. It is that on the surface, but at the same time, he is a kind of angel. He is a kind of God perspective on the American dream. That is to say, he, you know, by being present in the life of Jenny and present in the life of Lieutenant Dan and present in the life of the Bubba, sort of divinely inspires them and asks them and beckons them back to the path of having faith in the American dream, which seems absurd given the squalor that Jenny grows up in, which seems absurd given the fact that Lieutenant Dan has his legs blown off for no reason. And yet, when they talk to Forrest Gump, and this is why, again, people erroneously think of the character of Forrest Gump as being overtly passive or something within the film, or the film not making any sense or whatever, it's like he's not even really there. He's a spectral presence. It's like think of it like a Hal Ashby film. He's a spectral presence. When Lieutenant Dan pulls him down, and says, "I should have died on the battlefield," he's talking to God. And all of these things, it's rocket ships for Lieutenant Dan and it's birds for Jenny, and we'll get to that in a minute, which we see constantly being returned to over and over again.
You've got new legs.
Exactly.
Like Jenny Malloy.
Same as the rocket ship, exactly. And so what's interesting is that where is the God perspective? Now, we're looking at it from the outside, the idea of the American dream and Forrest Gump. You know, you're looking at, the idea of the American dream. It's tainted with sins, as we see with Forrest Gump's Ku Klux Klan past. It is tainted with, naivete and stupidity. How could you believe in these things? He's mentally handicapped. It's tainted with all of this bullshit. And yet we see, we're kind of examining it from the outside and yet seeing that it is always there and it is always inviting, blah, blah, blah. And this movie kind of takes place from within Forrest Gump's POV. That is to say, what is the perspective? Who are we that is viewing this living room from a space outside of time? Who is the person who sees in 1941, ironically, that the war is about to break out? Who is the person who sees all of these things having purpose? It is a perspective that exists outside of time. It is a perspective that exists from the spiritual world, essentially.
The God perspective.
Yes, and in that sense, you see the fundamental oppositions of the movie are that of, you know, the ordered world or the house or the boundary, which is time. You know, you're only given a certain amount of time. You're only given a certain four walls to this house. It is all of the boundaries of time that Paul Bettany as a character is very interested in. Again, he just wants to make money. He's very concerned with money. He then passes that on to his son. But the arc, if we want to get into Tom Hanks's character in this, Tom Hanks plays Paul Bettany's son, Richard, who is born into the house. Paul Bettany and his wife, played by Kelly Riley or something, I heard her name is, the girl from Yellowstone. Yeah.
Beth from Yellowstone.
They move into the house after World War II. They have a bunch of kids. There's a whole great sequence of Christmases that you'll just have to see it. It's fantastic. Where they grow up. But what we see in Tom Hanks, his son, Paul Bettany's son, Richard, this character is a character who is clearly obsessed with the other perspective early on. He is not obsessed with the ordered world. He is obsessed with the kind of spiritual God POV on the world, which is represented, because this is a film and because this is a frame that we are looking at with many frames within frames, he is a painter. and he paints frames. And right from the get-go, he's drawing in the living room in the house, and Paul Bettany, you know, says, oh, a picture of the living room, that'll be worth something. You know, obviously, you know, because the movie is a picture of the living room that goes on for hours and hours and hours. And you see that literally ebb out of him over the course of the movie, like water. But you see his, slowly, his love of the moon and love of painting, and it's kind of really, Bob Zemeckis uses, and this is present in many of his films, including in What Lies Beneath, he uses water to represent the spiritual dimension, to represent chaos, to represent, you know, and the moon obviously signifies water because it controls the tides, and we're introduced at a young age to Tom Hanks. He's painting the moon, and he's obsessed with painting. He's painting everything. And speaking of the association between the moon and water, we see him literally standing there, and to show the opposition between him and his father at a young age, water starts literally pouring in, chaos, the spiritual world, fucking with the ordered world of security, these boundaries they have created. And what is Tom Hanks's reaction as a character, as the teenage version of himself, is to start drawing his father, who has his head up through the hole in the thing. So as his father is innately kind of obsessed with trying to maintain order, we see that it is something that slowly gets beaten into him after he has a child, and then begins to, as he points out at the end of the movie, kind of lead a life of worrying, where he is only obsessed with worrying, just like his father, about keeping bad things outside of this boundary. And
just seeing kind of put it up to a point, or put like a real finger on that idea, when he gets his first promotion, or he gets the job of becoming an insurance salesman, where literally he comes home and his voice is really happy. He's telling his family, I got the job, I got the money, we're going to be fine. But while he's saying that, he's literally packing all of his paintings into a box. Mm-hmm. He's I would assume, putting it in the attic or something of that nature.
Yeah. No, I know 100%. No, and that's what I dig about all of that, is that then when it comes back, even at the end, the film gives you so many visual little, I mean, because it all takes place in this one space, so many little visual connections to the fact that when he finally, at the end of his life, rediscovers his love of painting and has placed paintings all around the room, you see a painting of that moment where the water is kind of pouring in through the ceiling and all of that kind of stuff. And I don't know, it's just really cool. And that's sort of the visual, that's sort of the aesthetic of the whole movie. It makes it, to kind of dive deeper into Tom Hanks's world, not unlike several other of Bob Zemeckis' films, it feels like a contemplation of It's a Wonderful Life as well, an homage to It's a Wonderful Life, that idea of we are kind of bounded to this place, you know, what is his name, fucking George Bailey, is constantly trying to leave his hometown, he is constantly stymied in his efforts to leave his hometown by chaos, by falling through the ice, more water references and everything, by, you know, all these different things. And then he realizes that that, you know, you don't know what you have until it's gone, it's right there in front of you, that the wonderful life he is leading is the thing that is happening in that small town, that he is making a difference, that he is part of this community, that we are defined not just individualistically, but we are defined in relationship to the people we love and the people we create and the people who are our family. And again, I know that is a very unhip idea, especially in the movie world now, but it is a very, very profound and resonant idea, I think, in a lot of films immediately following World War II, and a very profound and resonant idea now. And so it's just a cool...
I don't necessarily know how to fully articulate the thought, but I would like to maybe dive more into just the theme of memory, because I feel like there was multiple characters or multiple lines that kind of referenced...
It's a very good point. Yeah, no, I was saying that like that idea throughout, so just to kind of tee it up, you know, as these characters are, we get this sense that as they are born unto the world, they are very, very, very happy. As Robin Wright is young, she even says very early on, I could spend my entire life here. And then as all of the different troubles and things of life begin to pile onto them, they begin to become interested only in the time-bound world. Mm-hmm. They only seem to be interested in what they're losing, what's slipping away, all of that kind of stuff. And yet, it is only at the end of the film, once Robin Wright's character, who is Tom Hanks' wife, who then becomes his ex-wife, starts to clearly suffer from symptoms of dementia or Alzheimer's.
Some sort of memory loss.
Exactly. So she begins to forget, you know,
But she begins to forget the time-bound world. She begins to forget her worries. She begins to forget all of those things. And then it is only to kind of spoil the end or the final shot of the movie. I won't spoil it, but it is only at the end when we realize that there's almost nothing left in the house. The house has become a white construct. It has become a blank space, and just with two chairs in it, it has essentially become almost like a heaven dimension. An old Tom Hanks, an old Robin Wright, who we get the sense has lost all of her memory from dementia, enter in and sit down, and without completely spoiling the ending, you get the sense that it is in her forgetting all of that that has been lost. It is in her forgetting all of the time-bound world that she suddenly goes from someone who is very sad and worried to someone who is smiling and someone who, and again, there is a shot that follows that implies the idea of death and kind of transcendence mm-hmm. to another dimension. But it happens when she enters this space, this here, and I don't know, it's interesting because it's simultaneously about her forgetting, but then once she crosses that threshold, the arched door, she then remembers again this missing blue ribbon that her daughter prayed she would find, and then she finds the blue ribbon, and that's the portal into that time.
Right, it's a moment that's set up earlier in the movie. It's a seemingly unexplained moment. We don't know what the blue ribbon's for, just that the daughter really, really cares mm-hmm. about it. And when it's found, again, it's a small moment, kind of pass over it quickly in the movie, but when it's found, Tom Hanks says, presciently, this is a moment we'll never forget mm-hmm. when they find the ribbon. Oh, yeah, and sure enough, that comes to be crucially into the final the final scene of the movie and the final shot, which, mm-hmm. Let's say it finally departs from its POV. From its POV in a meaningful way at the end in relation to that.
No, for sure. And again, I don't think I have a full way of articulating the thought, but I think it's also just fun living a life, because we also saw it with my mom, so there's a couple of, you know, multi-generational viewing of it, but then you kind of see the couple become teenagers, the couple get married in the house, the couple kind of becoming first-time parents in the house, and then mm-hmm. at one point, a little bit of a spoiler, they are gifted the house, and mm-hmm. after this whole time, the wife, Robin, is kind of pushing him and pushing him, saying that we need our own space, we need to move out, we need to spread our wings, mm-hmm. and then she kind of almost gets a gift, in a way, of having the house. The parents are going to move out, they were going to have this their own space, quote unquote, and mm-hmm. then I feel like the goalpost even gets moved then, because she's not happy with the house. She wants their own space. She doesn't want to be in mm-hmm. that here.
Yeah.
And then ultimately to come full circle and realize that here was everything that she could have wanted.
Yes.
But then you kind of do get that little bit of a blinding of the time bound space.
Yes, yes, and that's that interesting idea. There's that I think it is Wordsworth who says that birth is a forgetting. You know, we mm-hmm. forget essentially that we are a sliver of the infinite, and then what once she has completely forgotten her life here mm-hmm. in this place, she then smiles and literally flies into the sky and becomes. There's another visual conceit where a different female character at an earlier point. We ran to the bathroom when the hummingbird showed the first time, so mm-hmm. I wanted to tell you about that. The Native American woman passes away, and then we see her husband as an old man, and he is visited by a hummingbird that is no doubt just not unlike Jenny, who wants to fly like a bird far, far away,
mm-hmm.
and Forrest Gump is the soul of his wife. And with her, at the end of here, we then see that same hummingbird with that idea, and even the idea that it is potentially still them. You know, it's the Tom Hanks and
Robin Wright
are the Indian princess. And, I mean, the idea is that it's the same soul. It's
a
green hummingbird.
I really like that.
And they've been living this life in this here,
and
falling in love multiple times, blah, 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 blah.
Mm.
And, which is a very, very, very beautiful idea. And so, at the same time, her death
mm-hmm.
is not just a forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
Or Alzheimer's, or dementia is not just a forgetting, but also a remembering that, you know, she is part of the infinite. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
No, that's a really cool thought. I hadn't, and I'm the first usually to jump at those thoughts. That's a really fun idea.
Yeah, no, it is. I don't know. It's a film of profound, not just metaphysical significance, but also of profound emotional resonance. Because I just found myself
just kind of being pulled into it the whole time and stuff. Yeah, and so the idea of forgetting and memory up here, this begins to be seeded earlier, mm-hmm. because what happens when Rose being the Tom Hanks's mother,
yeah.
Dies, when she finally dies, we see Paul Bettany, and that's when that's the scene we were referencing earlier, she enters the living room, mm-hmm. and her words are, "Why did I come in here? I can't remember." And we realize that her in death, we forget life, and in life, we forget what exists mm-hmm. beyond death, and that maybe part of that forgetting is, again, the fact that they were that Native American couple, and the fact that, I mean, we use a word like perspective, but this is a film that literalizes the idea of perspective. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, as you get older, you get perspective mm-hmm. on your life, that everything had meaning. As you get older, you realize that maybe your family and these crazy moments of, you know, trying to film your kid, having his first Christmas and the thing becoming unplugged, the lights becoming unplugged over again, the whole montage of Christmas mornings is Paul Bettany saying, "God damn it," over and over again, because you just see him hitting that point of frustration every Christmas where something's going wrong.
And also even in the wedding, just as a fun callback to that little mm-hmm. gag of the camera with the lights, he keeps
that comes back for the wedding. Mm-hmm. I love the detail of how, and again, the film on a very practical story level says, well, how do you show the wedding? Well, they put the wedding in the living room and you show it really pouring rain outside. So clearly the wedding was supposed to be in the backyard,
yeah.
and you see everyone crowded in and uncomfortable trying to get married in the living room. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's very good stuff. What we were talking about, I don't even remember. When Rose dies, you know, she says, you know, "I can't remember, blah, blah, blah." This is a film that literalizes the idea of perspective, because there is this idea that the perspective, the POV, that we are watching the film through is one where time doesn't exist. It is one where time is not something that is ebbing away preciously. I mean, it is precious within the film, and then it's gone, and it's a bad thing, but where you are literally seeing left to right, top to bottom, the perspective through which meaning is generated and passed on through our spirits, or through culture, or through an idea like America, or through the family, that there is a larger arc to the soul beyond the individual life, whether that's through reincarnation, whether that's through just the all-seeing eye of God, who sees that all of these different parts form a puzzle that all mm-hmm. fits together perfectly. And the film doesn't put a pin directly onto that. It kind of gives a nod to both ideas over the course of the film. But either way, it strips it away just to the philosophical or esoteric, you know, bare bones, which is there is a place beyond time, and there everything makes sense. And you can't remember it now because you're thinking too much about, you know, here, but when you forget about here, you'll remember there again.
Mm-hmm.
And that is about the best summation I could say of what are we all striving to try and achieve through, you know, meditation and through wisdom and through, having family and all this other kind of stuff, is gaining that kind of perspective. And so it literalizes the idea of perspective. What if you could see unbound by time? What if you could see the world through the eyes of God? What if you could see that you and her have been here before, and you've fallen in love before, and you've done this before, blah, 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 and maybe this long life that you guys have in the house now is a kind of karmic, you know, restoration of something you lost when the Indian princess died mm-hmm. all of that time ago. And so it's just, and because there's literally a moment where prior to Rose dying, they have these college kids come over that are all awkward and and they find the necklace of the Indian princess in the backyard of the house. Yeah.
Speaking of me running into the bathroom and missing the hummingbird scene with the man, when you went to the bathroom, there was a very sweet scene of the funeral process of the woman, who I assume might have even been the chiefess. Like, it seemed she was one of importance in the village. But that being said, she's being led through towards the camera mm-hmm. to her funeral procession, and the man asks to stop and actually says a prayer or says some sort mm-hmm. of chanting or some sort of words over her necklace, and mm-hmm. and that is what she is buried in. And so literally the next scene is that necklace being uncovered.
Yeah. I need to go back. And again, that's another great example of just the idea of, again, two things that are very distant
Over hundreds of years.
Yeah, from in the world of time, but from the perspective of the audience member, but it's not really an audience, is it? From the perspective of the untime-bound, and what is film but sculpting in different durations of time, or sculpting in this idea of time, from a timeless perspective, those events are simultaneous. And it's not editing, it's not story structure, I mean, that is one way to call it, but the film makes the more profound picture, or the more profound, I don't know, philosophical statement that we are existing within this here. We are existing within this frame. And this is not something, yes, it is bound by the cinematic screen right now, but this is a film that very much resonates on the level of saying, I think this is how existence operates. And in that same way, just a slight digression here, Cliff, and maybe this is something you're kind of would agree with me on, is that we're seeing a lot of our favorite filmmakers as they get old kind of doing these kind of look back things, and I think this film feels in a lot of ways similar to Spielberg's The Fablemans. You know, where you literally have many of the, and now we know that Spielberg and Zemeckis and Bob Z are friends, but you have a lot of the same oppositions. You know, you have Spielberg's mom, who is the chaotic person who literally takes him out water again into the middle of a thunderstorm and a tornado, and she's very free and creative and all of this other kind of stuff. And then the very orderly engineer father who only believes in what you can see and touch, and to her, films are dreams, and to him, films are just 24 frames a second being run through this machine. And the entire film explores those oppositions and that that kind of duality as it exists within, of masculine and feminine as it exists in Spielberg and in all of people. And we see the same contemplation here, this idea that, in a way, did we, almost at the end of, like, looking 25 years on from the 20th century, did we miss something? Was there something right there in that homey living room that was very essential that we forgot about? And we see that transition into modernity happening through a literal devil figure who shows up in the house. And he's one of the only people who, he kind of shows up in an almost uncanny way, where we don't see him enter through the arched door or exit through the arched door. But the devil shows up. He's just there. The devil shows up in the form of a marriage counselor. And he shows up, and what does the devil say? He uses the same water metaphor yet again. To talk, like, as it took for an example, right when Paul Bettany's loses his wife, I think first to her stroke, which is another real really beautiful moment with the Christmas tree and everything, he talks about envisioning her on a river, and she's out in a river, and she's being taken by the river, being chaos, death, the other side, the time unbound, and he can't get to her. He wants to swim out and get to her, and he can't get to her. But he knows he needs to be with her, even if it means dying, he has to be with her, blah, 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 blah. As opposed to listen to what, and I've only seen the movie once, but the marriage counselor uses the same river metaphor, except he says, you guys are in a canoe, and you're both fighting for control over the rudder to this canoe. So here's what I realize is that you guys, if you're ever going to be happy, you need to be in separate canoes. And notice he's using the canoe metaphor, enforcing the idea that they are, in fact, still the Indian couple from before. Again, more Americana imagery, the colonial versus the native, that being the other big opposition of the ordered world versus the natural or chaotic world, is that you have all this Benjamin Franklin colonialism representing the ordered world and the chaos of nature and God being represented by the Native Americans. Go ahead, sorry,
you're saying. No, you're right. I was going to say, even in the same comparison with the scene of the grandfather essentially mourning the loss versus that marriage counsel conversation, when the grandfather is having that conversation, saying that he's having those dreams, etc., he is going to his usual thing of pouring a drink. He's kind of throughout this whole film falling further and further into alcoholism because of his war, because of his PTSD, because of all these things. And then it is that monologue, for lack of a better word, that is him deciding and getting a trash can and throwing all of his drink back. And then you do see him becoming that person. You realize that Rose, you think at this point that she might have died. You do realize that she's just had a stroke, and she is still alive. And he is so clean in that next scene, where he's taking care of her, and he's doing all of these things, and he's, like, really cleaned up in a way that she kind of wanted him to previously. And then you kind of go back to where that is a positive resolution from that water metaphor, that divergence, where you can make that decision. Are you going to go further into your alcoholism, or are you going to clean up? versus the marriage counselor conversation of, are you going to tighten up the ship and really stop fighting on that rudder, or are you going to get in two separate canoes? And kind of on the negative side, they do get into two separate canoes.
Yeah, in fact, that guy, the two separate canoes devil marriage counselor guy, begins this little monologue by saying, you know, many people feel that marriage was analogous to, I forget what he says, like servitude or confinement or something, and you realize that, you know, he is essentially there to kind of be the serpentine figure whispering in the ear saying, you would be happier if you broke up your family. You would be happier if you were on your own. Which, in the large, especially him invoking the canoe metaphor, in the larger story that starts with them as the Native American couple having the child and her dying, and then them finding each other through time, and then being born again unto the house, the idea that this other figure with all of his ideas and his psychology is going to tell them that no, you would actually be much, much happier if you were separate. And again, we see her whole life. And again, another important thing is that, like, this movie, I mean, clearly, like, Castaway is a meditation on divorce, because I think, I don't know too many of the biographical details, but I know Robert Zemeckis went through a painful divorce, and I know in the same way that, and it's also a meditation on alcoholism in the sense that he suffered with that, from that, and which he also explores in the movie Flight, which is a really brilliant movie, and probably the best movie on alcoholism. And so there's this tragedy in the story where you almost know they're going to get divorced, even though in a weird way, I feel like the film could be, you know, it could be the story of unity, and even explores that idea at a Thanksgiving dinner after they become empty nesters. They say, oh, well, the kids are all out of town, so I guess we're going to be alone on Thanksgiving. And he invites her over, and Robin Wright comes and sits down, and he asks her after he reads a fortune cookie if she'll come back to him, basically. Mm-hmm. And she says no. And we realize that there is a consequence within each incarnation. There is a consequence to letting the time slip away. He had her for all of this time. He had her when he was focused
on 30 years, and they got together at, like I say, 16, and exactly. She sees her 50th birthday.
Yeah,
you know?
No, he had her for all of this time. He had her when he was fixated on capital gains. He's always like talking about taxes, you know, like capital gains tax or various taxes as to why they can't buy a house. She wants to leave this house. He knows on some level that it is her destiny, not unlike a caged bird, and there is that that metaphor yet again returning from Jenny in Forrest Gump, that she is going to become free of this cage at some point, and he can either go with her or he can stay behind in the here, and he stays behind. But even that, which is great, is that at the end of the film, he looks around and he says, as an old man, he says, blah blah blah, we lived here all of this, I have no regrets. And we realize that, well, shouldn't you have regrets? Shouldn't you at this moment be saying, I wish I had respected you, I wish I had done this, I wish I had done that? And the reason he says, I have no regrets, and it doesn't make sense. Well, you lost your wife, you lost her, you lost the better part of all of these years together, is that he realizes that the story is not over. That the story, just like us as the audience, just like the immortal soul that is both in the Native American warrior and him, has now gained this wisdom, has gained this perspective, this God POV, where if you view these things beyond time, he realizes that I've lost you before, I will lose you again, but now when I come back, I will know, or whatever. And that's, again, what we see as the hummingbird takes flight at the end, as we know, just like the Native American princess, that she will be back again, and he will be back again. And in that way, the film even takes something like
just as a quick note, the flower that is around the chimney is also with the pregnant Native American is picking. It's the only time you ever see those flowers.
I never would have noticed that. I didn't notice the flowers at the end, because the hummingbird touches on a flower on one of the chimneys, but I wouldn't have
noticed
that.
There's the quickest of, like, transitional scenes, essentially, where you see the Native American coupling, and then you see a couple of scenes later her walking past the mighty oak tree with a very big belly with a basket of flowers. She tries to pick up a flower, decides that she cannot squat that low, and then, like, walks back off, and then you're back to the main story. But it was just that quick moment, and then that's the flowering that's run around the chimney.
No, that's fantastic. Yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those things where you can't... It's kind of funny. It's not we're talking about the film as a film that exists non-linearly and in a world that's unbound by time, but at the same time, the film feels like something that it's almost difficult to contemplate the film. It's almost difficult to contemplate the film in a linear or causal way, because you can't talk about it. It's like, well, how is the script? And then what did they do with the script when they directed the movie? How are the performing? I mean, you can, but all of the things are quite literally simultaneous. And in that sense, it makes a very, very, very profound esoteric point that where the all from one shot conceit, or whatever the fuck, or however people are going to characterize it, is the theme. It is the theme manifest. The fact of you watching the film, even to a perhaps even more profound degree, I would say, than, you know, even something like The Fablemans, because The Fablemans literalizes this idea by making you contemplate the idea of cinema. Zemeckis does something, he takes that idea and makes it invisible, and he puts it inside of your own soul.
You know, vaguely alluded to it, but the theme is kind of present from the very beginning, from the eggs at the beginning, through every iteration of everything, is the idea of family.
Mm-hmm.
And what is, I don't know, what the relation between, I guess, different families over time, all occupying the same space, seeing just common familial themes repeat again and again and again. But I don't know what I'm trying to say.
If I can just start randomly saying crap about it, it's interesting to look at the moon being such a significant thing in the movie, because the moon is simultaneously water because it controls the tides, but it is also blood because it is associated with the 28 days of the menstrual cycle. Moves simultaneously. So it's also associated with birth and all of these kinds of things. And it is when he gives up, this is the same, speaking of similar films, the perhaps less aesthetically successful but equally interesting Megalopolis that we saw, we talked about a couple weeks ago, where quite literally someone's child is represented by the moon that then gets stolen away, is that when he's painting the moon early on, and then when he has his baby for the first time, he now takes his painting of the moon and takes his paintings down, and that sort of aspect. So he has decided...
But also there's a moment where he's holding his baby in front of a painting of the moon.
Yes.
Says, that's the moon?
Yes,
and
they say that's the moon.
And where the Native American baby is held out
in front of the moon.
Oh, that's such a good point.
Yeah, no, what I love, and this is the nice thing about... Just, again, the simple thing about the visual style of the film is by staying in one perspective the whole time, but jumping around between time, the film has the usual cadence of going to an exterior shot and then back to an interior shot or any of those things, because it will literally just jump to a time when the house didn't exist, and we will get a beautiful exterior and a moment when the Native American people are holding up their baby to the moon, and then it will just jump right back into a nice interior back when the house existed again. And so, yeah, but his art, his creation, again, this is crazy because it is similar things to the whole idea that's in Megalopolis, which is this idea that he loses his ability to freeze time, or which is Tom Hanks's ability to create paintings or create, he loses his ability to freeze time until he then gives birth to the child, who then has the ability to freeze time at the end of the movie. But in this movie, he gives birth to the kid, he gives birth to the child, he gives birth to his own flesh and blood. And that he explicitly blames in a at one of the angrier moments, just before she leaves him. He says, I had to make money. And we see him, he goes and he gets a sales job, and he pulls the painting down. He had to go make money to take care of his kids, to take care of these things.
To which he responds with, I am actually leaving you now.
Yes, yes, yes. And then you have these, you have all of these allusions to the idea that he thinks that the somebody he could be, or the life that he wanted to have, existed initially outside of the house, with wanting to be an artist, with his sister or someone saying, man, we were really convinced you were going to be somebody.
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. And we see that bitterness about what he couldn't do then become sort of metastasizes into the I had to make money angry guy who's not really there, who's no longer the romantic. You have the early scenes where the kids are out of the house but they're still in love, and she beckons him to the bedroom and he drops his pants under the moon again, and so you see that moon leaving them, that spirit leaving them over the course of the thing as he again chooses to worry about all of the various practical concerns. And yet we're seeing simultaneously all of these smaller incidental moments, the blue ribbon moment, all of the other things that constitute his life. We're seeing the Thanksgiving table where all of the family is arrayed. We're seeing that, the relationships that we have between each other are our life, that essentially is not just the relationships between ourselves across time, but between father, son, wife, husband, sister, brother, all of that kind
and
of stuff.
Oz.
Yeah, that all of these things kind of are this godlike perspective. And there's this universal thing that I think we're seeing Spielberg say with The Fablemans, and Francis Ford Coppola say with Megalopolis, and we're seeing now Bob Zee say with Here, this idea of there is something essential about family to the creative process, that they are somehow, not unlike this film portrays, simultaneous. You know, that Spielberg's creations are his family. Mm. That is to say, if the screen is a reflection of our subconscious, and our subconscious on the screen, and this is just true of screenwriting in general, you know, in movies in general, a person's family sort of is their subconscious. It's a representation of the interior reflection of their feminine aspects in their mother, and their paternal aspects in their father, and their more adventurous aspects, say, in their brother, who's about to go off and to volunteer to fight the fucking Vietnam War, or whatever's going on at that point. And that is not just, again, screenwriting, that's not just something that is disconnected on paper. The idea that our subconscious actually is our family, that we are all of them folded up into one person who then reflects that back out unto the world. So when he is making, and again, ironically, right as the girl is saying, man, we were really sure you were going to be somebody, what are they doing? They are watching home movies. Yeah. So there's literally a movie screen up in front. All the families are arrayed. And we're seeing the inverse. We're seeing the back of the movie screen being illuminated. You know, and I would probably sound like an idiot if I try and parse it.
I was going to say, just a reference back to the brother going off to the war. I thought that was a very unique scene, just in like three or four lines. But it was the brother announcing to them that during Thanksgiving he had enlisted, you know, grandfather having a conniption because he's a guy, I did it for you. Tom Hanks basically giving him some shit for it, and he literally responds, well, I don't need to hear any kind of lecture from my do-nothing brother. And that almost is like a confirmation that his biggest fears are what his family also thinks of him. So it can be,
For sure.
And then his sister in a later scene saying, oh, we really thought you were going to be somebody. He's like, fuck, so did I.
Oh, yeah, no, and all of that. And I don't know, just there's something about that idea that, again, there's a lot, everything from thematic resonance to metatextual stuff about the fact that they're watching movies during that scene. In a weird way, it makes it a reflection of Bob Zemeckis, because he is a filmmaker watching home movies in that moment. But he's also an artist, and the Be Somebody was, he was going to be this big artist. And the question then, it's almost Bob Zemeckis is contemplating, was it worth it to trade just a normal living room where I would still be with my wife and the mother of all of my kids to be this guy who I know would have been standing there in the living room thinking, man, I really could have been somebody if I was a filmmaker or I was this or that. And was the trade worth it? And, you know, and again, we're seeing the reverse side of a movie screen while all of this is happening. And sorry, just to complete that one, but I know you want to say something, but just to complete, because I'll lose it if I don't, is that idea that, what does family have to do with the creative process? What is Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, and now Robert Zemeckis trying to tell us about the integral relationship between family and creativity? This idea that if we are going to explode, what is inside our moon self, our interior self, into a cast of characters for us to see in front of us, then what are we doing except essentially becoming a lens through which all of these, all of the family members that contributed to who our subconscious, who our soul, who our moon self is, hit this lens that is our own self, and then are now projected out into Tom Hanks's paintings, into Bob Zemeckis's films, but for most people, and in the more universal sense, gets projected out into their children. Into they become a lens now through which, a membrane through which all of the inherited history and all of that gets focused, augmented slightly, and now, you know, goes from a single point, just like light, out into the prism of their many children. One of whom, and again, the way in which this manifests is Robin Wright leads her life in this here, but she never gets to see Paris, and she never gets to do all of these things. But we realize that her daughter, I think it's it says, moves to Paris or something like that. I think there's something about... Clearly,
they meet in Paris.
They meet in Paris, but ultimately you get the sense that her daughter travels around a lot, and there's a reference before the Thanksgiving scene to the idea that she doesn't come home very much or whatever.
Yeah, the idea at the beginning when we first meet the Robin Wright character when she's a teenager and is not yet married Tom Hanks is that she wants to be a lawyer. In fact, Paul Bettany, old World War II veteran father, thinks the idea of a woman being a lawyer, having a career, is weird. So clearly, the dream of Robin Wright Penn, unactivated, was of being a lawyer, of traveling around, of being a career gal, that her daughter actually gets to live out. So her daughter, Vanessa, actually becomes the career gal she always dreamed of being. Yeah. And she always dreamed of going to Paris. Yeah. So the career, successful career gal meets the mother in Paris. So finally she can vicariously live that dream through her daughter, realize that dream one way or the other, no longer being trapped in the four walls of here.
No, that actually was going to be what I was bringing up, was that sometimes I think there's even a smaller sub-theme of the movie is, like, the decisions that the parents do affect the decisions of the children. I think that that scene of the grandfather, but at the time the father character, saying, you know, I don't think jobs are worthless. Your mother wanted to be a bookkeeper, but, you know, she can't even see her own paycheck.
That's,
and then she leaves that scene saying, you know, you should go do whatever you want. And as she's leaving, she's like, I would have been a damn good bookkeeper.
Exactly,
and then
those
decisions kind of reflect on those parents making their own decisions, and then the daughter becoming the lawyer.
And in some way, that's even resonant on a different level, because Rose and Margaret, I think is Robin Wright's character's name, I'm just going to keep calling her Jenny, but Rose and Jenny are not blood relations, but they are family. In the sense that it is her, Rose's, unlived life as a bookkeeper, which you then see Paul Bettany's character, as you said, being very dismissive of, oh, blah, blah, blah. She can't even keep track of her own checkbook. Why wouldn't a good bookkeeper? Is, because we're observing it in the movie, clearly a pivotal moment for the Robin Wright character. She's like, oh, shit, like, I better go out there and become a lawyer, otherwise I'll end up just like her. And then she ends up becoming a house wife, and ends up not becoming a lawyer, but ends up, again, not unlike Tom Hanks, believing that there was some other better life outside of the life she was leaving that she could have left, and worried about that life, etc., 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 and what did that do at the time? It made her not appreciate the here and not appreciate the now. And then by the end of the film, all that, including even their own divorce, is ultimately forgotten. Because when he's leading her in at the end of the house, presumably she trusts him, knows him as her husband. In fact, I think we've heard of that instance actually happening, you know, where people suffer dementia and then actually forget about things like divorce and death and that sort of thing, and have to be reintroduced to ideas like that. But the idea that even their divorce is now forgotten, and they are just the same couple in the same here, in the same space, you know, being seen from a perspective that, you know, doesn't have any time associated with it, and then she smiles again. I don't know. Yeah. I feel like there's almost no way to talk about
great performances, too. Like, you had made a comment earlier about, we could talk about the performance. Great performances and great stage production. Like, all of the background details, especially the 1940s couple, I thought had just a great set.
Yeah.
It was like, you could just tell love was in it was in the script, was in the music, was in the acting, was in the everything.
And I can say also, Tom Hanks is just young enough to not suffer from, like, Robert De Niro in... I love The Irishman. I think it's a great movie, but the physicality of this, because there are no edits in this film, could not have been done by a Tom Hanks a few years older. Because he's just at that, you see in the interviews, he clearly lost a bunch of weight so that he could play the younger version of himself and not be, you know, big. But we even saw an interview clip where he's saying the way in which a 17-year-old gets off of a couch when he's excited mm-hmm. is very hard for a 66-year-old man to replicate. Those are Tom Hanks's words. And yet, despite, you know, you can say what you want about digital de-aging, I think they do it does a classy job in the first half of the movie using it, and then they make a whole to-do of a moment where they drop it, where Robin Wright, you've probably seen the moment in the trailer, walks up to the camera, says something about time flat passing by, and you literally see the digital makeup just fade away, and she's still wearing probably age makeup of some kind, but then they don't use it for the rest of the movie and just use practical makeup. What was I saying? I don't even remember.
The digital de-aging just works generally well.
It
worked better than The Irishman.
You see the physicality, like in a scene where Tom Hanks is playing with his kid, and he's running around and doing all this crazy stuff. Exactly, he's pretending to be a ghost, and he is pushing it. He's pushing that 66-year-old body, but they let it be him, and it still works. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's moments like when Robert De Niro and The Irishman like has to go kick the shit out of that guy, where it's like you really wish they had just used a young, like they could have
a younger body double could have been fine there.
It could have been, and they could have done the Texas switch because they just go, and it's not even a Texas switch. He chases the guy in, and then they come back out and he kicks his ass in the street in a wide shot in The Irishman, and you like you can't throw a punch because he can't raise his arm, and he can't kick because he can't move his fucking 70-year-old Robert De Niro hips, and so it just looks weird. But the digital de-aging and the rest of it looks great. This another thing about digital de-aging is just it looks awful in the trailers because you're just like, what the fuck? But in the movie, because you're just seeing it cold, you're like, that's not Tom Hanks. That's a weird plasticine golem pretending to be Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. But in the full context of the movie, in the full context of music and of characters that you're actually paying attention to, your suspension of disbelief makes it essentially go away. And
absolutely.
I was not thinking about the digital de-aging at all throughout the movie. So, I don't know. There's too much to say about it here. I keep going off on digressions because I'm so excited about every part of it.
It was honestly, I'll say this kind of vaguely, but the most disappointing thing about the movie was the lack of audience turnout. I think it was the four of us, because it was three of us and my mom, and then like two other people in the theater, and
oddly enough, we were sitting right next to each other. I don't know if they buy tickets next to us. It was oddly,
like the six of us all together.
All together, yeah, in this empty theater. And it's, again, I don't want to spend too much time on it, maybe not doing well at the box office or whatever, but if there is a loss, if you can, please see it in the theater, because it will be especially a film told in this unique way. You will want not only the big screen, but sadly, the most important thing, as we know, because this is the title of our podcast, is that the theater is crowded,
mm-hmm.
so that you are not just having these experiences, but you are sharing these emotional experiences with your neighbors.
See it with your family. Go invite your sister, your cousin, your mom, your dad. Go watch this with your family and talk about it afterwards.
No, absolutely. I think I immediately texted like 10 people when I walked out of the theater. You know, family members, friends. I was like, go see Here while it's in theaters right now. And I never do that for anything.
Yeah.
And I wish, and I think we will get this opportunity at some point. Speaking of time not existing, we were discussing this last week. In that we were we explored the time portal that was the 1995 show print of From Dusk Till Dawn, which had never been screened before. And we played that print, and we sat between the two projectors with the beams of the real switches going above our heads, and we watched this print that was struck in 1995 with 1,200 of our closest friends at the Paramount Theater here in Austin with Robert Rodriguez. We watched From Dusk Till Dawn, and we traveled in time. But not only did we travel in time, but Robert Rodriguez traveled in time, because he came out of that experience, and he said, this was the premiere that I didn't get in 1995. So right now, from the omniscient, omnipresent perspective of God, as you and I are sitting here talking about the fact that no one showed up to see Here today, there's a little window opening up right next to us on a radio that's letting us know that it's actually the year 2045. And in the year 2045, you and I, or 2044, we will be going to see a sold-out at the Paramount Theater screening of Here for its 20th anniversary, with a 174-year-old Bob Zemeckis and a 192-year-old Tom Hanks. And we, of course, will be asked to host that event because we were the OGs who were pulling for it from the beginning. And
here,
we'll be
here.
And so, no, anyway, but I, so, yes, it is disappointing that right now, in the time-bound world, we are not getting a Here screening. And to that end, by the way, It's a Wonderful Life flopped when it came out. And so the whole thing with
it. Most great movies, I'm discovering, kind of flop at the front and you kind of grow that audience.
Plenty of them have. And this is another one of those things where obviously many of Robert Zemeckis' films are contemplations of Frank Capra. But that was a film that failed. And for those who don't know the story, it's a very common story. It failed, and because Liberty Films failed, which was the only film that Liberty Films made after World War II, was It's a Wonderful Life. Because it failed, its copyright, I'm messing with things on the computer, its copyright was never renewed. Let me start over. Because It's a Wonderful Life failed at the box office, its copyright was never renewed, therefore, it's in public domain. Like you, that's why in many old movies we'll cut in clips of It's a Wonderful Life if they need something on TV, or Night of the Living Dead, another film that same famously is in the public domain, because they can, because no one owns it. Because it's in the public domain, it was played on TV a many, 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 many times and became the Christmas classic that it is today because it is a great fucking movie. And in this film that is definitely owes a great kind of spiritual debt to that movie, to It's a Wonderful Life. And again, you know, Back to the Future 2, as it's a riff on It's a Wonderful Life. We've been here before with Robert Zemeckis. It is a film of such unique kind of emotional resonance that families will want to watch together. It would not surprise me very much if in 20 years, after it plays on TV and people become transfixed by it, or people watch it on Apple TV and it becomes a favorite film, it would not surprise me if we could easily fill a theater here, but not now.
I was just thinking, like, because there's a couple of, obviously it's a family film and whatnot in the house, so there's a lot of Thanksgivings, a lot of Christmases, but there's not really a big Thanksgiving movie, and out of the two holidays, I would say that this is much more leaning towards Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
While you're cooking, like, while you're eating your leftovers for Thanksgiving, or even, like, once the football game is over, throw here on the TV. Great.
Will it be out on streaming yet? Not this year, but next year.
Probably
next
not in time,
year.
But yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is that there's moments throughout the film, and it actually makes me think of it, where because a Thanksgiving meal is kind of one of these moments where they begin to not only play with frames within frames, but begin to layer different times on top of each other in ways that are almost three-dimensional, in the sense that they end up doing stuff like in one time turning around a mirror, but then it's reflecting a different time within the within that frame, or a frame will open up and you'll see kind of through the house and someone will throw anyway. The various Thanksgiving meals and the Thanksgiving table and all of that other kind of stuff. I remember there's just one of those unique things that they kind of kept returning to. I don't remember what my point was originally, but the Thanksgiving meals were cool.
Yeah,
all the Christmas
scenes
were cool.
There were multiple pivotal scenes that involved Thanksgiving. And there was also Christmas scenes in the beginning of the movie, but I wouldn't necessarily. I would associate this more with Thanksgiving.
What's interesting is, and again, I'm just more and more things are just popping in here as we're talking about it. Just think about the important role that Rose, the grandmother, played in the role in the life of Robin Wright's character of Margaret. You know, she's the one who regretted being a bookkeeper. She always wanted to go out and blah, blah, blah. So that she passes that on to Robin Wright. Robin Wright does not pursue her career as a lawyer and feels somewhat bound up and trapped within the house. Mm-hmm. And yet these two women who have everything in common in the world are in conflict over something, which is the couch in the movie. And if you look, the couch of Rose is that of the domestic couch. It is all floral. Robin Wright hates it. It's old-fashioned. It's this. She hates the couch because she's been there. And then she replaces it with a modern sectional couch. And I actually love what they do with the sectional couch over the course. For Christmas, you know, they don't just make it disappear. They move it around all the places. You know how you would in your own living room, kind of shove the couch to an awkward side. Or, you know, anyway. But she buys a sectional couch that is made of leather. And what is Rose's critique of the sectional couch? It looks like something you would find in an office.
Yes.
You know, so Robin Wright's character of Margaret is taking her desire to be a lawyer, her desire to be in an office, and she's literally bringing the office into her home. Her kind of this unrequited desire to have a career.
And she does at one point, through her frustrations, even does get a part-time job, which much to her annoyance, her husband does not realize that she got promoted to a secretary.
Yes.
You know, she is finally, in the last of her life, right before she decides to finally leave him, is getting that taste of freedom. And it almost, I would say, almost overly makes you feel like, oh, this is a little bit, I can get it all, but then you kind of have to make that decision.
Yeah,
like,
no,
is
I mean,
it worth it?
She sees Paris. And I know that's another thing that I like about the movie is that it uses all of these archetypal Americana ideas, which is necessary to tell the story as in the way that it does, in the immediately iconographically recognizable way. That it, so it's like her great dream is not terribly complex. It is to see Paris. Why? Because Americans want to see Paris. There's literally a movie called An American in Paris. No, it's just that is the homey 20th century idea of romance. The idea, and the film throughout uses. Again, all of this kind of cultural shorthand that not unlike Forrest Gump, I think will take a long time to kind of fully parse out, layering World War II over Native Americans, over the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and all of this other kind of stuff. I don't even remember how I got on this subject.
I got in a little bit more of a real divergence. I feel like the one storyline that we haven't really touched base on was the more contemporary storyline, the family. A little bit of a spoiler, but they do ultimately sell the house. The main couple does move out, and it is taken over by a more contemporary African American family that has a nanny. Uh-huh. I couldn't quite figure out the name, but it sounds like a long term live in nanny.
And
they have a lot of contemporary stuff. They touch a little bit based on COVID. They touch a little bit on the African American police brutality conversation, but that's really it. And I kind of, in hindsight, kind of feel like. I know it is better to kind of touch on a contemporary timeline. It has all these historical timelines, but it doesn't connect into the greater story in the way that the Native American has the necklace that gets pulled out during the Robin Wright or the Tom Hanks and Robin story. And I kind of kept waiting to see, other than the realtor being the same realtor that opens the house at the beginning of the movie for Tom to see it, et cetera, et cetera. I would like to rewatch the movie to see if there's maybe a connection in that storyline that almost feels.
Extra? That's we were talking about that on the way out of the movie, and I think it's one of those things that by virtue of being the most contemporary story, it automatically loses some perspective. Here's that word again, the perspective benefited by time on what is going to be resonant about this period. And considering when the timeline of this movie started, 3 or 4 years ago. No doubt it was very, very, they thought it would be very, very resonant because the contemporary storyline, it deals with a few contemporary issues, but it's essentially the timeline that makes reference to COVID. They wear masks, the house, there's a whole sequence where the housekeeper realizes she can't smell anything, blah, blah, blah. And while that obviously was a huge and significant cultural event, and the film does a really great job, uses that to tie this time in to previous times, as there's a whole late 1800s, first people to occupy the house, perhaps?
Early 1900s.
Yeah, early 1900s. Yeah, early 1900s.
A pilot and his wife.
Yes, exactly.
We have a pilot and his wife. Planes are new, planes are the way of the future. We've set him up to die of a plane crash because his wife is very worried about it's such a dangerous thing. And indeed, when he does make his end, it is surprisingly not due to a plane crash, but to the unmentioned influenza, which we are to assume because people are wearing
masks.
Very COVID-like masks, is the 1918 Spanish flu that many people compared COVID to before.
That actually does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. And again, what's great is think about that on a couple different levels. So you have them wearing masks for the Spanish flu, you have them wearing masks in the contemporary timeline, so that's cool. You actually also have the same dreamer versus pragmatist oppositions that Eric Roth and Bob Z use in Forrest Gump. Because the spiritual dimension of Lieutenant Dan is represented by rocket ships, by the mechanistic desire to build something and fly. whereas the kind of the spiritual dimension of Jenny is represented by birds. And in this, I didn't realize it until just now having this conversation, but yeah, I mean, so much is happening so quickly, but it's another version of the same couple. Tom Hanks is the wife, the worrier, the one who's constantly worried about... Tom Hanks is the basically plays this Victorian woman who's very uptight and very... She does not want her daughter to fly in the plane. She thinks the plane is something new, therefore the plane is a death trap, blah, 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 blah. And Robin Wright's character, who once was an Indian princess, is in a sense manifest in the man, the aviator, because of course he wants to fly, and not unlike Lieutenant Dan, because he has a masculine character instead of it being represented by birds, as it is with the hummingbird in this and all the doves and everything in Forrest Gump, is represented by an aeroplane. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know why it's the future, he just knows that it is the future. He wants to fly, he wants to, you know, just like Lieutenant Dan's legs, that the future is mechanistically upward. In that way. And in that way, that couple again becomes another surrogate for our couple, where Tom Hanks, you know, being the kind of more conservative character, was born as a very stuffy woman for, you know, one of his many lives, mm-hmm. and was very worried about airplanes and very worried about things, mm-hmm. and that Robin Wright was once born as a daring aviator at some
point. Bought that house because the
because it was close to a because it was close to an airstrip. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And then I guess what is it? And then we can kind of look into if we want to talk about anything else. Yeah, there's all the there's. One of the more overtly conspicuous aspects is the fact that Benjamin Franklin's in the movie.
Yeah,
you know?
Like a main character, almost.
Yeah. No, yeah, yeah, he shows up, and he's in essence a main character, he's just not corporeally a main character, he's just referenced because the house across the street is Benjamin Franklin's son's colonial home. Mm-hmm. And it's a big old house across the street.
Or his father's.
Yes, and so, yeah, and so, no, yes.
It's Ben Franklin's illegitimate son. Illegitimate making son, reference okay. to his father, Ben Franklin. Yeah.
And the whole idea, of course, bringing it up to our contemporary moment, the son believes that his radical political father is a terrorist and all this other stuff, which, honestly, in a theater full of only us and the other couple seeing us, mm-hmm. it was the one of many moments that actually got a simultaneous laugh out of mm-hmm. the entire audience. Because when the father was complaining that his son, the son is complaining that his radical father's political ideas make him a terrorist, like everyone just got a big chuckle out of that. But again, just like with Forrest Gump, just like the fact that Forrest Gump is playing with everything from, you know, images of all of the great wars, all of the great presidents who Forrest Gump visits as a kind of angel of death. Every time Forrest Gump visits someone spectrally, somehow improbably makes his way back to the White House again, mm-hmm. the person gets killed. So the film, again, creates this opposition between the colonial, the ordered and time-bound world, and then the infinite world of the Native Americans, this idea where literally when we are with them, the house has yet to be built, so there is no bounded world that has yet to grow its cocoon around our perspective, mm-hmm. around our POV, around our wisdom, our perspective, and literally they hold their child up. Oh, there we go, timer going off. They literally hold their child up to the moon, mm-hmm. and just say, you know, this is our world, and then we see slowly the ordered world, A, cuts down the tree that was there during the whole time. The scene when he's giving her the necklace, a squirrel runs up the mm-hmm. tree. The very first thing they do when they move in to start building houses is timber! Chop that fucking tree down, which is now much, 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 much bigger.
Fun fact, yeah. Actually, that timber is a different tree. They mm-hmm. they actually don't ever see that tree falling. It is a timber is a different tree.
Oh, you see
it
as a stump. Yes,
yeah, and then you see it just as a stump.
Yes, no, that is true. That is true.
I don't know why, but that caught me.
Oh, no, no, for
reason.
Sure. No, it's just, I think even just the abruptness of just seeing it suddenly become a stump is, I think, part of it. Yeah, no, it's really, and so you kind of see it grow up around that. And yeah, again, so, and in that way, and again, there's a whole monologue of quotes of Benjamin Franklin that are delivered not by Benjamin Franklin, but as Tom Hanks and his brother are both playing Benjamin Franklin. And what's hilarious is they're both Benjamin Franklin when they're young, and then when they get slightly older, the son goes off to one of the brothers goes off to join the Vietnam War, and the other brother is staying at home, and they're on other opposite sides of the political whatever the fuck, and they start arguing with each other. And so it's an interesting, the political dimension, the dimension of America as represented by Ben Franklin goes from schism to unity to schism all over the course of the whole thing and stuff. Colonials, Native Americans, all that other kind of stuff. I don't know. I feel like it's such a cool movie. I could literally go on. That's the sad part. I could literally keep these mics running for an additional hour just recalling deeper and deeper layers of meaning and subtext from this movie. And
we will. This is the
we might record. We'll have to go see it again and then record an entire second episode because I'm sure I'll see it again and realize that all the different things I missed. Anyway, it's, I don't know, it's perfect cinema. It is a almost magical object in that, again, it is like, hey, it retroactively makes all other cinema seem more profound, you know, in the way that all, if you view this cinema this way, why couldn't you view all cinema that way? That it is the non-corporeal POV of God looking in a way that is beyond time, so that even though Frodo is struggling his way across Mordor and everything's meaningless and lost, we're still having a good time on some level because we know, because we can kind of see around the bend, we can see through those little frames that it's all going to work out. It all makes sense. Even those people who died are not lost. Mm-hmm. They are, in essence, restored, and they will be coming back again. Because what is gained is not what is gained materially, whether that be even the life of the Indian princess, which is lost, or the wealth that two generations of the family are just trying to acquire and failing to acquire. It's not any of that, because those things can be lost. That what we gain is what we are experiencing as the audience, the actual emotional transmutation, the spiritual transmutation, the wisdom that we take from it. We are different people. Every one of us were the same people at the beginning of that movie as we were at the end in manifest reality. That is to say, at the beginning and end of here was only 90 minutes in our lives, and yet we were changed for all that we had experienced within that. And what it's saying is, it doesn't matter if you get $1 billion or you lose $1 billion. It doesn't matter if your child lives to be 100 years old or you end up, you know, sadly, you know, losing them in your life, that what is to be gained is, quite literally, that perspective, the perspective of God, God's POV, the idea that you are going and coming again, and You've been here before, and you will be here again. And so it is the lesson that is learned that he takes with him. You know, his love of the moon that he had when he was an Indian, he still has when he's Tom Hanks. And the lesson he has now learned, the perspective that we now have for having seen the movie, when he gets to the end, he says, I have no regrets. Because if he didn't do those things, then he wouldn't have that perspective, and we wouldn't be leaving the theater with that perspective. So the wisdom, God's perspective, is, you know, that, whatever the hell I was just saying. I've lost it now. So,
that vein, though, and to kind of maybe even cap off the most esoteric notion of this movie, do we want to maybe transition into our tarot?
Yes, you're right. That's a good point. So, what a perfect movie. I in literally trying to contemplate what this movie was, I found myself using a tarot as an example in my own mind. Because part of the fun thing about a tarot deck is that there is no beginning and no end. You know, the cards can come in any order. You can simultaneously be born as a fool, which is the first of the trumps in the tarot deck. You know, when you're 70 years old, as you begin some new wild venture after your wife passes away. Mm-hmm. Or you can complete an entire journey, you know, when you're 6 years old, when you of the world card, which is the final trump, you know, when you move to a new town and make friends or stand up to a bully. It might bring to close some other journey in your life. And so each card individually in the tarot deck, just like the frame in here, doesn't tell you what order to absorb the images within it. I mean, the movie does a little bit more with sound design and other things, and it guides your eye very effectively. I could have a whole conversation about how Robert Zemeckis is just guiding your eye the whole time in the movie. But the Queen of Wands, you know, say, or the Queen of Pentacles, say, Is it the yellow background that's significant that hits you first? Is it the queen on her throne? Is it the fact that the queen is holding the pentacle in her hands? Is it the fact that she's looking at it and contemplating it? Is it the emotion on her face? Or is it the little rabbit that's in the bottom corner of the thing? You can look at any of those things, and whatever hits you, that might be the thing that is significant in whatever order. And there's almost no way for me to describe the movie of here, as it's not a magical object, not unlike a tarot deck, as it is the simultaneity, both in a single frame in any given moment and across the breadth of the film of all of these events, is the fucking point. So in some way, I don't know, I was very excited to do a tarot draw, because as we say every week here on The Crowded Theater, we can only speculate as to the greater meanings of all of these things, but of course, the actual meanings and lessons within the film are only for the God POV of here itself, what the whole movie was about to tell us. So how, Taylor, do we interact with that POV? I'll get it out there eventually. How do we interact with that POV? We are going to consult the spirits, and we did a tarot draw prior to the thing, asking what lessons, which felt like a dumber question when we were doing movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon and Young Frankenstein. What lessons do the films that we watch each week have, not only for us, but for the viewers at home to take with them? What wisdom, what God perspective can we take with us? And I am very curious to see what the spirits have to say about here. So, Taylor, how about you draw that card and hand it to me? It is
upside down.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Cool. This is the Six of Wands. Six of Wands right here. Excellent. So the Six of Wands, there you go, pulled in reverse. But the Six of Wands represents, and I can honestly understand the reverse as well, the Six of Wands, the wand is the suit of, well, like we were just discussing a moment ago, I was just discussing pentacles a moment ago, the suit of fire and the suit of magic, or the magical component of life. And that is the suit of cinema in some way. It's just giving us a magical perspective on existence that exists outside of time. The card is a card of victory. That is to say, we see a man atop a horse being heralded by other people. And this, however, as Taylor points out, came up in reverse. And I think what this tells us is that in the time-bound world, right now, here, will be discussed as if it is some sort of failure, perhaps, not a great success, because essentially the card means success and the frustration of that success. People will look at the fact that critics, I have not read any reviews of the film, but I saw a friend told me that certain critics are being ungenerous with it, and I think this is also the case with the whole of Robert Zemeckis' career, so it does not so surprise me, but that it will be viewed in some ways, if it does not make a lot of money at the box office, if it does not get a bajillion Oscars the way that Forrest Gump did, that I'm sure that it definitely deserves, it will be perceived in the interim, in the short term, the time-bound world, if you will, as a failure. And yet, why was it the Six? Why was it the Six? Because in the untime-bound world, all of the inverted cards are upright again. And so the film is, in essence, a tremendous success. In fact, it is a crowning achievement. You see him aloft atop a white horse being heralded and paraded by people. We are perhaps few of those voices now, but we are a seed that is being planted that will grow, and eventually there will be more voices. So, as we see here to my right here, as a little window opens up onto a radio, that is now, because we don't have TV in the year 2044, we only have radio again for some reason, is telling us the date and how President Barron Trump is now being elected to his seventh term, and has now become a giant worm atop a dais, just like in Leto Atreides, in the Dune books. Don't check the math on any of that. That doesn't work time-wise, but it's only 20 years from now. But
we're working in a non-time-bound world.
Yes, we're working in a non-time-bound world, where we will have, mark my words, and I'm recording it here, we will be 20 years from today returning from a sold-out screening, and we can't believe how many people came up to us and emphatically shook our hands and thanked us, just like this card. thanked us and heralded us for doing the screening because they grew up watching Here in their own living room.
Yeah.
And it changed the way they viewed their living room, and they had an emotionally resonant experience. Well, let me just say, as past Kyle currently, as still very young, handsome, virile Kyle, you're welcome, everybody. You're welcome. And we called it all the way back here, so there you go. Taylor, you have any messages for our future selves as we get back from our very successful screening of Here, where everyone was fighting to get inside but couldn't?
Taylor, your hair looks fantastic. Change nothing.
That is true. That is true. It's very
well. No, great movie. It is a fantastic movie. It definitely will be, I can see it now, a new family classic. I really do want to see it become a new like Thanksgiving tradition movie. I think it's a holiday that I've always said doesn't really have a good movie family vibe, even though it's like the family holiday with the meal and the football. Mm-hmm. You need a good Thanksgiving movie. And Scooby-Doo with the big giant turkey just isn't cutting it anymore.
Have we seen Home for the Holidays with Holly Hunter? I don't think I've seen
it. We have not, no.
We'll watch that sometime. That's a pretty good movie.
In a theater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool.
But yeah, on that note also.
Oh, yes, and we should award the Full Metal Jacked Award. I almost forgot about that. But well, okay, so I thought this was your segue to, but go ahead.
It's not. It might be an NA for Full Metal Jacked. I don't think anyone has their shirt off in this movie. What was I going to say? Yeah, just as concluding remarks, this is clearly, even though it's probably not going to do too well at the box office, not a lot of people showing up, but clearly, for anyone who sees it, it's one of Robert Zemeckis' best movies. It's a masterpiece, beginning to end, from Robert Zemeckis, one of the great directors of all time. Also not a common opinion amongst the film intelligentsia, such as it is. Is there a film intelligentsia anymore? Are there critics? Mm-hmm. Is that even a thing that exists?
I don't think they exist.
So anyway, it's one of definitely one of Robert Zemeckis' greatest movies as one of the great directors, so no doubt in time, as people watch movies, it will rise in esteem as time goes on.
Yes, and not only that, but it is also wholly singular in what it is. So I think it is the kind of thing that will just open up whole vistas, ironically, in people's minds, young filmmakers' minds, in terms of the possibilities of what you can do in cinema. Because they will always have this as a reference point of, you know, Here, you know, where the whole movie takes place in one spot. So, Cliff, because we will give out every episode the Full Metal Jacked Award, who was the most jacked person in this movie?
Well, based more on seeing his interviews after the fact, I probably have to give it to Tom Hanks, who, though 66 years old, managed to, one, regain the silhouette of his youthful form, which I think Robert Zemeckis probably made of necessity of him do this. He made him lose weight for Castaway before, so this is yet another much milder than Castaway body transformation. But, yeah, in order for the digital de-aging to work, Tom Hanks had to regain the silhouette of his youth, and also to perform it, had to regain a lot of the springiness and bounciness of his youth. And for that physical performance, which is great, where he can physically act like a 17-year-old all the way up through an 85-year-old man or wherever he ends up at the end, definitely give the Full Metal Jacked Award to Tom Hanks.
Fuck yeah.
In that vein, though, with him jumping around and being very, I literally thought to myself during the ghost scene, I'm like, oh, that's the Tom Hanks from Big. Like, he literally did some sort of jump, and I'm like, that could have just been pulled from that movie.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point. It's something that, David Mamet talked about years ago, that it's an actor's job to be physically robust so he can do whatever he can be called upon to do on stage. And so Tom Hanks, like, took probably more so than Robert De Niro or Robert Pattinson as Batman. I wouldn't know, though, because I haven't seen The Batman. He's not The Batman. Tom Hanks took seriously the idea of actually becoming physically prepared for this role. And so he definitely earns it. Full Metal Jacked. Because he needs some hip mobility to do those moves he did at the end. So he was doing yoga, Pilates, something like that.
He was stretching.
Okay, I feel like I have volumes more to say about Here, but obviously you know, that would be boring to listen to. So
if everything that we have already said doesn't convince you to go see it, then I think you're probably just not going to see it, which is a shame.
Yes.
But I think everything that we said convinces you, go see it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think also, this is just one of those things, hopefully we will get the chance to see some more of Robert Zemeckis movies in theaters as they pop up. And stuff, some of the repertory stuff as well as it pops up, like Forrest Gump and stuff again. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that we will have myriad opportunities in future episodes to talk about here, because in a way, and I do not think this is an understatement, I think that here is a film that in some ways informs every film that has ever been made, especially the Robert Zemeckis movies. But it is the easiest and most literal way of I don't know, concretizing, you know, proving, manifesting the relationship between cinema and the spirit realm. That is to say, cinema as the perspective of God, the perspective of the spirit world, all of that kind of stuff. I can think of no other film. There's plenty of films that make film that are about that idea. Megalopolis was about that. The Fablemans is about that. But it, as a weird talismanic object, almost is the connection between those things. It allows you into that POV, but then the POV of the unbound, time-bound world. But then it which immediately asks the question, why not view all cinema this way? And I don't think many people do view cinema this way, except for, you know, many of the masters who actually make cinema, who, it seems, seem to view it this way, because they all seem to be making movies about the same shit in their 80s and stuff, so you get it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, cool, guys. Cool. That's all I've got for right now. So how about we wrap this up? Well, I guess for the crowded theater, I am Kyle.
I am Taylor.
And I'm Cliff.
All right, well, we'll see you next time, guys, and we'll see you at the movies.
For being here with us.
Thank you for being here with us. All right.